I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
What's up, Brad?
How are you?
What are you doing, guy?
What am I doing? Just finished this Clutch interview, which went well.
Yeah, Jean-Paul, he's cool.
Once we got it going, once we get the tech sorted out.
I know. Let's not talk about that. That's boring. You know what's funny is that he's like, I was asking, I'm like, oh, what should I call you? You know, do you like JP? Do you like Jean-Paul? And he's like, yeah, I like Jean-Paul, but not everyone likes saying it. And someone just did that to me the other day. They had a like a slightly difficult Greek name, but really not hard at all.
Right.
And they were like, if you want to call me Nick, that's fine. I'm like, no, I could sort it out. You know, like the thing about that is it scares me what kind of conversations these people have previously had that me being able to say their name is some kind of anomaly, you know?
Yeah, I agree. You should be able to say Jean-Paul. Jean-Paul.
Easy.
Whatever.
Easy. Even though I always think of that guy. Just give me the mic and pass the draw. Pop another bottle of limo.
Jean-Paul. I worked with that guy. I recorded him.
You did?
Yeah, I hung out with him a few times. Yeah.
Was he cool?
I know his lawyer really well.
He seems cool. He seems like cool. Fun to be around.
Dude, he's from Jamaica. Come on.
Yeah.
Like.
What's that mean?
They're all
I've never
cool.
been.
Yeah, Sean DePaul remix.
Oh, God. Cultural appropriation. We're going to get canceled, Brad. Stop it.
No, I love Sean Paul. Come on, man.
So guess what I did for the first time today?
Did you do any stonework?
No, but I fired up a chainsaw.
Oh, nice.
I did it. I got one.
Is it gas
and honestly,
or electric?
It took like 2 days of reading instructions and watching tutorial videos for me to fire the thing up because of how nervous I was.
Did you get any chaps to go with it?
I didn't get chaps. I just wore jeans. Yeah. And it was like, I'm not going to like get a chainsaw and show up for the first time in fucking chaps. I just feel like an asshole. So I literally am wearing like a hoodie, just like my gardening gloves. I got good goggles. I'm wearing my Bose like noise canceling headphones that I listen to music with. I'm such a rookie, dude. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
Is it electric or gas?
I went gas.
Right.
I was gonna go electric. I wanted to, and then some people I asked for advice, like basically like man shamed me. You know, they're like, "Yeah, gas is the way to go, bro." Like, I had, like, four different people tell me that. And I'm like, I just want to charge a battery and cut a few things. Like, do I really need to do all this? No, yes.
Electric chainsaws have come a long way.
I heard they're good. But then I was like, you know, half my reason for all of this is me, like...
to make noise. You want to rock.
No. It's about the idea in my head that, like, the apocalypse... I don't know if the apocalypse is coming... but something crazy might be coming. I don't know. So the idea, I don't want to get into like firearms and bows and arrows and shit, but I want to be able to take care of my stuff. So if like the power goes out for 4 days, I think I still want to be able to use a chainsaw, you know?
I thought you were going to say that as a weapon, a loud gas-powered chainsaw.
I didn't tell you what I'm using it for. I just said, if the power goes out, I still want it. I didn't say I was cutting a fucking log. I'd definitely slice a human with that thing. It's not the greatest weapon, though. It's a little clunky. I feel like I'd be better with my axe.
It only works in video games.
Yeah, or that movie with the... Where's the people's face?
Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I'll tell you right now, watch for like branches where knots are, because the thing about a chainsaw is just the kick. Yeah, when it kicks, that's what you got to watch for.
Yeah, actually, Vanessa, who's, the publicist for Fat Records and stuff, I was just emailing her about something, we're chatting, and just in passing, I'm like, yeah, I got a chainsaw, I have poison ivy, blah, blah, blah. And she writes back this really serious email, like, I know someone who sells houses in, like, Hudson County. Apparently people who come from New York and, start homesteading, slice themselves with chainsaws all the time. I'm like, oh, no, that's me. Oh, no. And I'm like, I know there's going to be a learning curve to all this stuff. Like, of course,
right.
I can't like come here and know all of it, but I don't want the learning curve to be like fucking eight fingers. I don't want to be like Jason Pierre-Paul over here, So right. I wanted the learning curve to be like, oh, you put the leaves on the street wrong. I didn't want it to be like, yo, you sliced your leg in half. Apparently, 'cause people are wearing fucking chaps. But anyway,
you'll be okay.
I feel like people who listen to Clutch, like prorated, probably have a decent amount of chainsaws. This is a decent, actually, way to intro.
Yeah, they're probably all going like, oh, come on, dude.
But I remember the first time I saw Clutch. It was like 95 at the Stone Pony in Asbury. We talked about it in this interview. They opened for a band called Tad.
Yeah, I remember Tad.
And I went for a band called Standpoint, who was like a female-fronted, like post-hardcore band from New Jersey, who I loved. And like my friends put out their records. I would go to all their shows. So we went down there just for them. And then I remember Clutch playing, and like I was like 15, and I was like, holy shit.
Right.
Like I thought something from like the 70s hit me. I was like, because at the time, no one was doing that, like, just straight, like, to me, it was just blues rock. I didn't understand the minutiae of it at the time. And I was automatically impressed with it. And then I love how Clutch, like I said at the end of the interview, have just, like, so fiercely always done their thing that they're the example to me of, like, any band. Like, yo, just do your thing. Get your sound, keep improving it, write good records, and like the world will bend to you. You don't bend to the world. And, and they were the classic example because they were a band for, over 10 years, maybe 15 years, when all of a sudden, like CKY and Bam Margera starts liking them and they tour with his brother. And all of a sudden, Clutch is on like MTV being talked about from all these people. I'm like, look. This is a lesson to you youngsters, like, do your thing, be awesome,
right?
And the shit will wave to you, you know. You can't wave to it. That's the trick. And I think Clutch has like mastered that, you know.
You gotta follow your heart or nobody's gonna follow you.
Yeah, and write good songs. I mean, he even said it when I was asking about the label. It's like, none of this matters unless you pay attention to your music and pay attention to your songs and your albums. Like, you know, put a pig in a dress. You know the expression?
Oh, yeah.
You heard this?
I've heard the expression, Benny.
I'm not familiar with this expression. I appreciate him. I appreciate you, Brad. Let's listen to this interview.
All right. It's going on track!
Wait, so do I call you JP? What would you like to be called?
You can call me JP. You can call me Jean-Paul if you're comfortable with that. I like Jean-Paul.
But I do too.
Some people get kind of weirded out by the sort of double first name and they don't know what to do.
Now, a lot of people down by you have double first names. They just have usually like the creepy school shooter ones, not like a nice pretty one like Jean-Paul, you know?
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah. You have a great background, though. I've been on a lot of Zooms lately, and I noticed now in the Corona era, that your like Zoom background is a thing. You know, some people set up like staging. Some people have cool rooms. Some people are super whack. You can even tell on like ESPN, the guys behind them set up like books that they want the world to see that you read, you know?
Right, right. And I bet a lot of time and effort goes into choosing which books it is you put on the shelf. And
1,000%, yeah.
And I wonder like how many of those folks actually have read maybe even a quarter of those books.
It's like, I know from touring that, you know, there's just this like, you know, dozen or so books that if you deem yourself like an alternative punk rock person, you have to have on your bookshelf, you know?
Right.
Like the prerequisites.
Uh-huh.
I don't think people have read most of them. Like, how many of these kids are actually leafing through the entirety of, like, People's History of the United States? I don't know. It's a tough read.
Yeah.
What would your book be? Like, if you had a couple books to put behind you that encompass your Zoom being, what would they be?
Well, I can tell you that in my very early days of touring, I read the Miles Davis autobiography. And at the time I was just sort of soaking up a lot of new music, and that autobiography for me, it did a lot. I enjoyed it because I just loved the way that Miles spoke. And the author, I think, did a really great job of sort of trying to encapsulate his vibe. So that was super cool. There's a lot of curse words, a lot of motherfuckers in there.
Yeah.
And but it was also great too because, you know, he was such an interesting figure in jazz. He was there for so many of the developments of that music, and reading that book was kind of like, it was really a jazz history lesson. So that's one that I've read a few times in over the years. And I really love Cormac McCarthy as well.
Oh yeah. The Road. I read the Road.
Love the trilogies, all the Pretty Horses.
Okay. Are all of his books as rough as The Road? Cause I remember being like, maybe 150, 200 pages into The Road going, it's going to break, you know, it's going to give me it's going to get a little easier to read this at some point. And it was just brutal all the way to the very end. Are they all like that?
Yeah, they're all. He's got a great way of describing terrible things in a very beautiful way.
Right. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, sure. I love his books, and his books are so dense that I find I can read them a few times, and you keep getting new stuff out of it.
What did you think of the Viggo Mortensen film for The Road? Did you like it? The adaptation?
Yeah, I remember watching it. It was pretty depressing. I can remember going into the studio one day, having read the book but not seen the movie. And we were recording in Baltimore with our buddy Jay Robbins.
Oh yeah.
And I can remember, you know, sitting there at my drums, and Jay was kind of placing microphones around, and he was unusually sort of somber that morning. And I was like, Jay, man, what's up? You seem kind of down today. And he said, yeah, you know, we watched The Road last night, and it left quite an impression on him. It took a few weeks before I gave it a shot, and I found it to be just as depressing. So,
can you be like influenced by pop culture like that? Like, can it change your mood? Are you affected emotionally by it?
I think that book certainly, the movie certainly did. The book does as well. Yeah, I think to some degree, sure. You know, I mean, depending on what you see around you, what music you hear, what's going on in the, you know, current events, all that stuff. I think kind of influences how you sort of view things, especially as a musician. I think we are so open to all of these influences around us that, you know, they're going to affect the way we play one way or another.
Yeah, that's a fact. And going back to the jazz thing with Miles, so you had a jazz background, right, when you were coming up in music?
Well, very early on in my my time in this band, I was able to take lessons from a drum teacher named Walter Saab. And at that point in my life, I was in my early 20s. I had taken some drum lessons before that. I knew something about jazz. I found it interesting, the lineage, you know, the evolution of the instrument and why players played the way they did. So I had the opportunity to study with Walter Saab, and Walter was a drummer that started playing professionally in 1946.
Wow.
So he was really there in the very earliest days of the music when they were developing this vocabulary. Sure. And so it was really great to study with him. He taught me a lot about not only music, but how to be prepared for any kind of situation that came to you. He wanted his drummers to be able to play with anybody at any time and make the musician feel comfortable.
You stress versatility.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's probably the most valuable thing I learned in my time with Walter. I learned a lot of curse words and in ways to describe people as well that we won't share right now. They're pretty off color.
But are teachers like that? I've never had a teacher like that. Are the movies? What was that movie that came out a few years ago with the crazy drum instructor? That stuff is real, huh?
To some extent, you know, there's actually a lot of people who watch that movie and we're getting emails from them saying, "Hey, this is what Walter was like," or "I hear Walter."
Oh, wow,
like.
Really?
And to some degree, he was a really hard dude. But I think the drum teacher in that movie at the end of the day was kind of a dick.
Right.
You know, and sure. Walter was not like that. Walter was, he used very coarse language. He insulted you a lot. And it could be about anything. It could be about your weight, your ethnicity, your age, the music you play. It didn't matter. He didn't care.
Sometime that he got you?
I'm sorry?
Can you think of like a particular instance where he nailed you on something?
Oh, yeah. He'd call me a fat whale.
Oh shit! Oh man!
Yeah, you fat whale, get downstairs and play what we talked about last week. It'd be one of these things where you would go to his house and you don't knock on the door. You have to walk in because he doesn't want to get up off the kitchen table and go let you in. You have to let yourself in.
Wow!
And so
and this was in D.C.?
This was just outside of D.C. in Maryland.
Okay,
and only Maryland. And so you'd walk in the house and then he'd say, "Hey, did you play that shit that we talked about last week?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, go downstairs and play it for me." And so I'd go down these stairs and sit in his basement, and he would sit upstairs and finish his coffee and smoke a little bit of his cigar, and I'd play whatever that lesson was. Inevitably he'd come down the stairs as I was playing this lesson and say, "No, no, no, no." But it was really just it was just this sort of rough exterior, and I think I learned later on that he put up that front because he didn't want to deal with people who were not serious about music or the drums.
Right.
I can remember specifically taking some drummer buddies of mine over there to meet Walter because I was so impressed with this guy, and each time I went over there and spent time with him, it really was a lesson.
Were you a teenager at this time?
I was in my early 20s. I had just started touring with the band. I kind of knew a little bit about drums. I was feeling comfortable with my playing, and I knew that this was something I wanted to do. I enjoyed the drums so much, and it was something that really resonated with me. I realized this is something I want to do for a living. You know, this is my passion. So I was able to hook up with him, and I learned later on that I think that rough exterior was a way of him pushing people away who weren't serious about the music. I remember taking drummer friends over there, and he'd start in with whatever kind of insults that he would do. And he was really good at sort of sensing it. Like if he saw that you had a sensitive point, he would do his best to needle you. But it was really because he didn't want people around him who weren't serious about the music, who weren't taking the drum seriously. Right. And if you weren't that person, he didn't have time for you. So get the hell out of the house. I treasure those moments, and I'm thankful and honored to have been able to spend time with him.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I saw you listed as a drum influence at some point. Washington D.C. go-go music. Can you fill me in on like what the vibe is there and what drummers kind of turned you on from that scene?
Sure. Well, you know, I heard go-go music even before I played drums. I didn't actually start playing drums until I was 16. Prior to that, you know, I was a kid in junior high, and I liked heavy metal. I liked AC/DC. I liked ZZ Top. I liked Ozzy. But I also really loved this other music that was happening, this thing called go-go. And at the time, I didn't realize that it was strictly a local kind of funk. It's a real percussive kind of music. There are congas and cowbells and drum set players along with keyboards and bass players. And there are different sort of takes on the music. It originally sort of came out of maybe the Washington D.C. soul and funk scene, and just sort of evolved into this thing that's just really, really heavy, and it's really rhythmically dense. And so there would be songs that were played on the radio, specifically maybe like Chuck Brown, a song called Run Joe would be one that you heard all the time, which is actually a Louis Jordan song that Chuck played. And then there were other bands too, like Trouble Funk, Experience Unlimited, Rare Essence. And so all these rhythms were something that I was exposed to at the very same time that I was listening to Black Sabbath. And so for me, it was just all music. It was just all drums, and I just soaked it in all at the same time. But you know, it's those first things that you listen to. It's those first things that you hear that really kind of make an imprint on your musical DNA.
Yes.
And you know, and so hearing Chuck Brown's Run Joe on the radio or at a high school dance, for example, I remember going to dances, not because I would be able to dance with girls, because I was a total dork and afraid to go speak to any girl. Right. But I loved hearing this music through the PA, just cranking, just loud. And I remember just standing there in front of the PA speakers, just listening to this music, just taking it in. And, you know, that was a really valuable lesson, and that informed how I hear the drums even to this day.
So go-go is specifically like Washington, D.C. funk.
Exactly.
From the 60s and 70s?
It started in the early 70s, and Chuck Brown is sort of credited with being the godfather of go-go.
Okay.
And the idea was then that he talks about in the early 70s playing these nightclubs and noticing that when the band stopped playing, people would leave the dance floor. And so he said, let's not stop. Let's play in between. So they started to build these rhythmic segues from one song to another. And eventually this turned into this thing where Chuck would hit the stage and he would play for 2 hours straight.
Wow.
No stops, no breaks in between the songs. And he would navigate the band, you know, through hand signals. The bands were always very well rehearsed. And so it would be this thing. And so I think that's where this term go-go came from. Go-go. Keep playing music.
Keep it going.
Don't stop. And that way people kept partying and the bar stayed busy and the dance floor was packed and everybody made more money. And then this beautiful form of music came out of it.
Yeah. It's funny, so I was just reading about one of those old package tours from the 60s. And apparently, you know, it was like one of the ones. It was the Rolling Stones' first one that they did in the States. And they did it with, I believe, Bo Diddley and the Everly Brothers and stuff like that. And apparently each one of those artists had 3 songs in 10 minutes in this night, and there was also an ice cream intermission in the middle where apparently everybody got ice cream. So I can imagine by the time this was rolling around, there was a we needed like something super consistent that went through.
Right, right.
That's cool. Well, I can kind of hear it in Clutch too through the years, you know, how kind of came out of the metal scene, but we're never really a metal band, per se, because it always had that kind of extra groove and movement that didn't really feel metally to me. Now how did that happen? Because you guys started on Earache Records, right? Which is like pretty much a total metal label. And from the outside, you were viewed as a metal band to a lot of people. Was that okay with you guys and something that you tried to get away from? Or
it was not something that we consciously made an effort to stay away from. But you know, even before we were sort of classified as a metal band, even before that, we came up in the hardcore scene.
Oh, okay.
The East Coast hardcore scene. And right. And so we would play shows in Baltimore, in DC, and then we would go up to Boston and play with some hardcore bands up there. I don't think we sounded like any of those bands, but the hardcore scene was such a vibrant community back then, and I'm sure it still is. But back then, that was an easy place to get shows.
Yeah.
The other side of it would have been sort of like, you know, this kind of leftover hair metal scene that was happening.
Right.
And that really didn't work for us.
Yeah.
Sure. And then the other scene that was happening at the time was the DC Discord scene.
Yeah.
And of course, Fugazi was sort of like the greatest of them all. But then there were bands like Jawbox and Fidelity Jones, and several others. And that was a very sort of closed community. We would go to those shows, especially Fugazi. I'm such a Fugazi fan.
Yeah,
those shows that we saw back then were just such powerful moments. But that was a really close community. And the idea of our band getting a show with Fugazi, although of course we would have done it, that was completely off the radar for us. There's no right. way that those guys were going to have us because they heard our riffs.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, they were like, no, you're
tough scene to crack anyway.
So the hardcore scene was kind of a natural fit for us. And it just kind of evolved from there. From there, we started playing with some metal bands and eventually we got signed. We first put out a 7-inch. On a little tiny label called Inner Journey Records.
Okay.
And, you know, we made a 7-inch and we thought, this is it, man. We got a 7-inch. What else is there?
You're done. Yeah, I know. Oh, weren't the 90s great? Things were so simple.
So from there, you know, we just grew. We signed to East West Records, which was a subsidiary of Atlantic.
Yeah,
and right. we started touring, and early on, we got some really good metal tours. We got a couple tours with Sepultura, which was huge for us.
Yeah,
we were huge Sepultura fans. Around that time, we went out with Pantera. And then from there, we just started playing with all kinds of different bands, like, you know, Marilyn Manson and Bad Religion.
Right.
And we were never not concerned about the bands that we played with. We didn't care about that. We just wanted to be sure that we had a good show because we knew if we just get up on stage and we just play our asses off, play our songs, that there's going to be two or three people out there that are going to dig it, you know?
Sure.
And that's kind of how it grew. It grew just from getting out there and playing in front of, you know, people every night after night with different bands, different kinds of people. And you know, and from there, you know, I think that's why we have a pretty diverse fan base now.
For sure. I mean, that's sort of the question I was alluding to is because where did that come from? You know, that wherewithal, because, you know, you were playing with hardcore bands, metal bands, but you were always Clutch, you know, from early on, from the early 90s. You guys had that Clutch sound and you're kind of locked into it. Like, how are you so focused on knowing that's what you were, especially at a young age? And having the confidence to play with all those different bands and not allowing it to change you and just continuing to do your thing.
Maybe part of it was because we never subscribed to one genre of music or one particular scene.
Mm.
We were not afraid to play with different kinds of bands. And I think our record collections at the time reflected that as well. You know, back then it wasn't really cool to listen to ZZ Top.
Right.
You know, but I thought it was really cool. You know, I liked it.
Like a band, yeah.
You know, I liked Agnostic Front and I liked Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Right.
You know, and so all of us kind of have that. We all listen to different things, but everybody's listening to different stuff. And it wasn't so much about trying to make the local scene. It was really more just about playing music that we liked, and playing music that we thought our friends would dig. Mm-hmm. And then recording music that we liked, you know, and it was really that simple. You know, we did not look at it as an opportunity to start a career.
Right.
It was just about, yeah, let's jam. And then there's a show next week. I think we can get on that bill. You know, I don't know. Leeway's going to come down and we're going to open for them. It's going to be great. Yeah. Let's do that. You know, and it was that simple.
That's awesome. I remember seeing you all at the Stone Pony sometime in the mid-90s with Tad.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a local band called Standpoint, who was a really heavy female-fronted hardcore band that I was super into. And that's actually what got me to the show. But it was the first time I saw Clutch, and I was like, holy shit, that is good stuff. So you started and have been running the label since 2008? Since right. about then, uh-huh. How did that all like come together? And after all this time, you know, good like 12 years doing it, do you really think it's the way to go?
Well, I'll start by saying, that for sure it is the way to go.
Okay,
and I think all of us musicians, I think the more quickly we embrace that idea, the more quickly we can move on with our career, because there are so many. Right. There are so many musicians out there who are concerned about, oh, I need to get on this particular label because they're going to be the ones that are going to pump me out to the people. And you know, that kind of an attitude is just putting off the inevitable. You know, we can see it every year that goes by. The label really only functions as a bank these days.
Yeah, sure.
So we figured, you know, Let's give this a shot. And by that point, we had been on several major labels. We had been on independent labels that wanted to be major labels. We were on independent labels. And we weren't satisfied with any of those situations. And we figured, you know, let's give this a shot, because if we suck at it, it's still going to be better than whatever they're doing.
Right.
And it was kind of a go for broke kind of attitude. You know, and we're still learning. You know, there's still every release we learn something new. You know, it does require that we as musicians take on a little bit more responsibility, that we open our eyes a little bit more than to just the music. You got to think with a business sense.
Sure.
You know, the return is, it's great, because not only are we cutting out the middleman and we financially it's a better situation to be in, but creatively it's better too, because I don't have to be concerned about, oh, well, the A&R guy doesn't hear a single on this particular record.
Right. Sure.
Or the label says we got to wait because such and such is going to put out their record first and then we can go. Mm-hmm. No, you can call your own shots, and at the end of the day, if you screw it up, it's your own fault.
Right. No one else to blame.
That's right.
Now, after doing it this long, is there anything with like the day-to-day operations or things that you could tell, you know, a band thinking about doing it that could help them make that step?
It's not as difficult as you think it is. Even if you don't have the knowledge or the wherewithal yourself, there are plenty of folks out there who do, especially in today's climate where record labels are sort of, they're atrophying, you know, their staff is being laid off or being fired. There's a lot of people who have business sense that are still into music, that are willing to help. So I think that's the first thing. Find, if you can't do it yourself, find somebody who can and work with that person. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we did in the early days. We hired a label manager, to do the day-to-day stuff. That's not to say that we weren't involved, because we were. Every decision that happened, we were consulted with.
Yeah. But when you're on the road or something like that. Yeah.
Right. So find somebody who can help you do that, or maybe your band has a guy or a gal that has the interest and the knowledge to be able to do something like that.
Sure.
But it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's not that hard, man. I mean, we're talking about, you know, record a record and get it up on the streaming services. It's not that difficult.
Yeah, these days.
What is difficult is coming up with material that you can be proud of.
Right.
Material that sounds different than other folks. That's really where that's the challenge.
Yeah, setting yourself
apart from the other bands that are out there.
Sure.
And I think that comes from a combination of having put in the time on the instrument to be able to express yourself in that way. And also have the interest in doing that. So, you know, some people just pick up the guitar and they're like, look, man, I want to play like Dimebag. And that's great because we know Dimebag is awesome, but you know, you got to be able to think beyond that. If you really want to make an impact on music today.
I see. That's awesome. All right. I want to take a little turn here. Okay. Something very personal to me. Drummer jokes. All right. Now I don't do well with them. I never have, you know, I always found I have enough pride to swallow being a drummer, okay? Like, I know no one even knows it's my life's work and you don't care I'm back there. The general concept annoys me enough that I don't need fucking drummer jokes. But do you like them? And if you do, do you have a couple doozies for us? Because I know Brad likes them a lot.
No, I don't really have a lot of drummer's jokes. I don't mind them, but I think when they get passed around, it just shows, the folks' ignorance because in so many ways, you know, the band can only go as far as the drummer will push the band, you know? I also think there's a thing with us drummers too, that we kind of have, an organizational kind of a mind.
Yes.
I've always been like that. I've enjoyed that part of it. You know, when's the next time we're going to jam? What's going to be the next band practice about? What's going to be the next recording? Sure. Who's touring? What's going to be the next show? I enjoy that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And I think maybe as drummers, I think we kind of naturally take on those kind of responsibilities. I think it has to do with the nature of the instrument. Maybe that's because, you know, we do not rely on amplification when we're in the jam room, for example.
Yeah.
You know, your sound, sound.
There's a physical part of it too, where it's just like drums require a house or a basement. They require a vehicle big enough to move them all around. They require the management of way more large like pieces and things like that than the other people have. So normally like it just lends itself to being the basement you practice in, or the guy with the van, or the one who knows how to fix a bunch of shit. You know, like there is like a utilitarian thing that just lends itself to drumming. I mean, we literally got pieces of wood in our fucking hands, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, you're just hitting shit.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Isn't that awesome? Sometimes I think about that. I like look around. I'm like, holy shit. I got like my house. I'm just hitting shit.
Yeah.
Just sweating, basically. Just sweating and hitting stuff. Brad, how do you feel about this comment? You feel left out for once?
I have to just chime in and say that, you know, there's justification. I've been really tortured by some total psychopaths and some horrible drummers. And so, I mean, I don't know how much house hunting you've done, but like the only thing that I can think of is like, it seems like realtors are people that think, I can sell real estate. Anybody can do that. So there's like, your chance of running into a fucking realtor who actually like knows what they're talking about when they walk into a house is so slim, because 90% of them are fucking idiots who think that it's an easy gig.
Well,
that's the only way I can sort of like frame my point of reference of being tortured.
You it's know, a I'm good not. Enough metaphor that I'm not even offended, because it's pretty smart. I do like that.
That's of course, good. Getting a good realtor does not like make or break, you know, you could still buy a good house without a good realtor, but you can't have a good band without a good drummer.
Now you're going too far. All right, so no drummer jokes today. Okay. But also, one interesting little pivot I wanted to
make. Do you
want to
tell
was,
one, Benny, just since you've already started it?
Wait, no. What do you mean?
You're not going to tell a drummer joke after all that?
I don't even have one because they literally just offend. You got some?
No, I can't think of any right now.
All three of us, not one drummer. What about a bass player joke?
Not right at the moment.
All right, we're done. This is done. So, Jean-Paul, tell me, I recently just got into home ownership with a giant lawn, and I heard about your interest in yard work and a giant stone project you took on. Any yes. tips here you can throw me?
Well, I can tell you, if you're going to mess with stone, do it while you're young.
Okay. Backbreaking work.
Yeah, it's well, you know, I started a stone project, probably 10 years ago.
Okay.
And I got about 80% done with the project, and then tours just kind of started, and then we were making records, and the project was never quite complete. And when the pandemic happened, of course, I found myself with a tremendous amount of free time.
A bevy of free time at the house. Yeah.
And I thought to myself, well, now is the time to finish up the 20% of the stone job that you never did finish.
Sure.
And I was shocked and alarmed to learn just how heavy that stone really was.
And it became a little heavier over the few years.
It became so much heavier. So that would be my word of advice. Do it now before you can't, because I tell you what, man, 10 years made a big difference. Those stones got a lot heavier.
Yeah, I just said that to my wife today. I was sitting there thinking last night, I'm like, you know what? My physical window is closing. Anything I want to do that involves like that part of my life, I really got to get on, because it's just not even going to be possible soon. So I heard a cool quote from you that I wanted to talk about. It was a quote where you said, I want to be able to practice things, not necessarily because you want to be able to play everything, but rather because you want to be able to play what's in your brain and then have that come out onto the drums, which I think you talked about a little with the aforementioned Walter Sopp. So do you believe in like an everyday disciplined creation, like even if you're feeling it or not? Like, is that the kind of creator you are, an artist you are?
That's the kind of creator I strive to be.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you for sure, you know, these last few months have been not the most inspiring times for any of us. So, you know, I get up in the morning and I have my coffee, and, you know, sometimes I don't really feel like going downstairs and cracking stick control again for the millionth and tenth time.
Sure.
But I think, you know, it's like working out, right? Like the hardest day is that first day back.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get over that hump, it becomes easier. And then there becomes a point where it's almost addictive, and you're sort of always doing it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I don't think my situation is unique in that there's an ebb and flow in that relationship with the drums. It's something you have to work on, though, you know, especially in times like these where it's tough. It's not like I'm getting ready for a tour.
Right.
You know, we get together and we rehearse a few times a week, but it's not as if we're you know, getting ready to go to the studio next month.
Right.
So when you sit down to practice, it's got to be because you want to practice.
Yeah.
And there's, you got to be able to see the bigger value in that. I think the quote that you're talking about maybe refers a little bit to practicing these things so that eventually the pathways to your limbs, they're clear. So what you think in your mind comes out on the drums.
Mm-hmm.
Very few of us, I think, actually are able to attain that level of musicianship. But right. I strive to do that, you know.
Sure.
And it it's something that you have to nurture. You have to cultivate that. And also you have to couple that too, I think, with music, you know, because all book work and no music doesn't get you very far either.
Right.
You have to, I try to balance the two, you know, practice for a while, have some kind of a regiment, whatever that is. And then maybe just, you know, put on your headphones and play along to something, you know?
Yes.
And I think the two of those sort of work together.
Yeah, I've had a bunch of conversations with younger artists, and that's why I wanted to talk about this, because, you know, this idea that you always need to be, like, struck with the, you know, this eureka moment or this, you know, idea or something like that. And people are like, yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm waiting, like, the vibe is right. I'm like, well, how the fuck are you going to know how to play it when it strikes you? You know, like, just because it's in your head, you know, you still need the physical tools to get it out there. So it's a mix of the two.
No doubt about it. Yeah, you have to maintain that. You know, hey, look, there's different kinds of players out there. No doubt that there are some brilliant folks out there who might not be able to touch a guitar, for example, for 5 weeks and then pick up a guitar and be able to play something. You know, I'm not that kind of a drummer. Yeah. I need to maintain that relationship with my drums. And you know, it's not all like, oh my God, I feel like John Bonham today. It's not all like that. You know, I had a day yesterday where we got together to rehearse, and it's been a little while since we had, and I felt like an idiot. You know, like, what the fuck am I doing over here?
Training
wheels.
You have
to have those days. You have to have those days where you're like, what is this thing in front of me? Why am I beating this thing? You have to have that, because that's the relationship with the instrument, and it is that, you know, it's the drums require that you spend time and energy, both physical and mental, to be able to say what you want to say on the instrument, I think.
Yeah, and it's you brought up the best point too to me, who's Bonham, who, like, Bonham didn't know he was Bonham on every day. You know what I mean? It was like his lack of being impressed by himself is one of the things that made him so good.
Right. Right. And knowing that, you know, chances are, you know, there's going to come a day when all of us will not be able to play the way that we want to. And we're just going to have to know, look, we did the best that we could.
Yeah.
You know? We were true to that instrument. We were true to the music, and we played as long and as hard as we possibly could. And it was, but you can't ever expect to get to that level. You know, when right. Oftentimes I'll run into young players who, you know, they're quite full of themselves, because they're very quick, you know, and they can play all that double bass shit and look at all this stuff going on. And you start to realize that the more you think you know about the instrument, the less you actually really know.
Yeah, and if
you can humble yourself a little bit, watch other players, listen to a lot of music, take it all in, you'll learn that, man, there's so much to this instrument that you can learn that you can't possibly conquer it all.
That's right. And you take one of those guys who's, you know, or girls who's super crisp and, you know, doing that really intricate double kick stuff, and you just throw them, like, hey, play some AC/DC for me. Play some Weezer. You know, and see how it sounds. They don't know what to do in space. They get all scared. They're like, well, I don't know what to do with my hands. They get all freaked out.
Right. And you said the best word too. How does it sound?
Right.
Because that is the key. You know, if you can play an AC/DC beat and make that feel good. That's, for me, that's way more challenging than playing any of this other intricate, fast, crazy shit that's going on out there, because it's all about the space in between the notes.
Yeah.
You know, I had the opportunity to take some drum lessons with my favorite drummer out there, Johnny Vodakovich.
Okay.
Johnny is a drummer from New Orleans, I love his playing because he can play the entire history of the instrument from the earliest turn of the century, funky ass march shit to some Tony Williams stuff, to some funk, to some rock and roll. He could play it all. And the thing that I learned the first time I had a lesson with him was it's all about the quarter note, right? So we've got a quarter note happening here, and the quarter note, that's the downbeat, but all the cool stuff happens up here in the space, right? In the space, that's where all the funk happens. That's where all the excitement happens. Uh-huh. That's where all the swing happens. So don't be afraid of that space and embrace it. Just because you don't have, 32nd notes flying through the, 16 bars of the chorus doesn't mean that you played shitty.
Yes. No, not at all.
Right. Right. You're listening to the music. So don't be afraid of that space. Embrace that space. 'Cause that's really where the music is.
That's right. That's right. Now, how did that work? Is that part and parcel with, you guys making a switch to working with like Vance Powell? And I know you've always tried to record live, but there was an extra focus on recording together and live during that process. Is that all in the same headspace?
Yeah, I think so. You know, each record is kind of a reflection of what happened last time, you know? Mm. And I think we do that on two levels. There are times when we're like, let's do something different. Let's talk about it a little bit. Let's try this different kind of approach, or let's try this a little faster or slower. Or we did something like this last time, so let's do this time. But also, I think there's something that happens with us that's sort of subconscious at this point,
right?
That we naturally just try to deviate a little bit from what happened last time around. So I think that's the first part of it. The second part of it is the decisions that the band can make to really kind of go out of their comfort zone. Mm. And when we work with Vance Powell, we were all in the same room together. We played the songs from beginning to end and really did the best we could to come up with a performance the whole way through. It really wasn't about sort of slicing and dicing the different takes to come up with what ended up being the record. It was a different way of recording, but I think it's important that it's not necessarily a better way of recording. It's a different way. It's a different mindset. And hopefully we can sort of embrace both ways, and we can make great records either way. You know, prior to working with Vance, we worked with Machine.
Yes.
And yeah. Machine's a very different kind of a producer. Okay. He's very much, everything's on the click, and to varying degrees, the band members might play some or all of the song on their own, right, without other members being present.
Sure.
So it's just a different way of making a record. And you know, that's part of the fun of being a musician too, right? Being able to try different things and see what the outcome is, and not being afraid to be like, well, that fucking sucked. We won't do that again.
Yeah. Yeah. So you guys were down at the studio in Nashville and Berry Hill over there.
Yes. Yeah. We had a great time there. The thing I think that kind of drew me to his sound, there were a couple records that I listened to that he had engineered, and one of them was Chris Stapleton.
Oh yeah.
And my brother-in-law is a huge Chris Stapleton fan, and he'd play this record over and over again. And I was impressed with it because it didn't sound like other country records that I had heard. We can argue whether or not Chris Stapleton is a country musician or, yeah, you know, but the sound coming out of the speakers at the time to me was different than other stuff that I'd heard. The drums had kind of this really deep, lush kind of depth to them. And the vocal, I remember too, just being huge. And at that point we were ready to try something a little different. I don't think Vance had worked with the band quite like us before.
Right,
and yeah. I think for that reason, I think he might've taken on the challenge because it was different than other stuff that he'd done.
Sure.
And man, we had a great time down there. Nashville's a cool town. There was so much good food there.
Yeah.
God. And Vance was great. I learned so much from him. He's an incredible engineer. Watching him put drum mics up and then going back and tweaking those mics, to me, blew me away. Just watching him move the microphone, just, you know, a half inch here or there, moving overheads, just a little further away from the drums or a little closer, whatever it might be. He's really in tune with not only the sound, but his gear, and he knows what his microphones are going to hear. And so it was great. And also, he's hilarious.
Right. Yeah. That guy's a pill. Does he still have that little dog that sits under the mixing board?
No, I didn't see a little dog
there. Okay. I made it through that studio once, and the dog maybe wasn't doing so well. I don't want to bring that up. That's a bad thing to bring up. So you guys, you're 12 studio albums in now, right? Is that right? 12?
I think so.
Right?
Yeah.
In the ballpark. Sure. Yeah. So, like, is the Clutch songwriting process at this point? Is it just like a formula that you guys have really mastered, or did it adapt with technology? Like how are you guys approaching that?
I think that's one of my favorite parts about being in this band, and that is that the songwriting process is totally different from song to song, from record to record.
Cool.
It does involve a lot of us just getting into the room and just playing. And so much of the stuff that we play ends up not being on the record. Mm-hmm. And it took some time, I think, for us all to just be comfortable with that.
Right. You know,
we'd get together one afternoon and maybe each of us would bring an idea to the table, you know, whether it was a drum beat or just a bass line, and we grow stuff from there. Or sometimes Neil will just show up at the rehearsal and he'll have this thing and he'll be like, man, you know, this is this goofy song that I was working on. I don't think it's very good. You guys are going to have to work on it with me. And,
right.
You know, and then he plays it for us and we're like, no, we're going to do exactly what was on your recording.
Okay.
You know?
Like, nah, dude, that smokes. Yeah.
And so to me, that's the coolest thing. There's not one way that the songs come together. For that reason, I think we're able to kind of strike a different tone from record to record.
Cool.
There's not just one dude writing all the riffs. I will say that there is only one guy writing lyrics, and I'm very thankful for that.
Right.
You know, yeah. Neil is by far, in my opinion, by far the you know, the most talented lyricist out there and the most talented singer out there. He's able to sing about stuff that most people would not associate with rock and roll.
Sure.
I think that adds a lot to the depth of the sound for the band.
Yeah, some of his lyrics are almost like kind of like tongue in cheek and almost funny at times. Where I'm like I think he's fucking with me right now.
He's probably fucking with you.
Yeah, which I like. does he share thoughts on melody and lyrics like prior to getting into the studio? Is that an open thing, or is that really just his department?
But maybe that's one of the things that has changed. Is that over the years, there's more and more an idea of what the vocal is going to be doing in the record. In the very earliest days, you know, we would get in there and we'd play the riffs, lay everything down, and then he would come back afterwards and put the vocals on it. So mm-hmm. there was a lot of times when we had no idea what the vocals were going to be.
Cool.
And, you know, to some degree, that's exciting.
Sure.
But as the band has grown and over the years, we have a better idea of what's going to be happening vocally. Maybe a lot of that has to do with having worked with the producer Machine. We worked with him for the first time on the Blast Tyrant record that was released, I don't remember, sometime in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Machine is very focused on what's happening vocally. And prior to that, you know, we weren't listening so much to the vocal. It was more about like, let's get this riff this way and let me make this beat this like this. And I think in a lot of ways he opened our eyes on that record in particular to what's happening with the vocal and how do we support that vocal. So maybe that means, you know, tweaking the riff a little bit so that it doesn't step on the cadence of the vocal or the rhythm of the vocal. And that concept, I think, has grown over the years to where now, you know, we'll be in the jam room and we'll have some riffs and we'll be sort of cycling through this riff idea. And Neil will start singing stuff, but it's not necessarily even lyrics. Maybe it's just words or a melody, sure. but it gives you information as to how ultimately that vocal is going to sit in the track.
Yeah.
And you know how it is as drummers, you know, that information is crucial.
Huge.
So I've found myself over the years paying more and more attention to it. And also thinking about something that Johnny Vodakovich told me one time as well, you know, make the musicians feel good. Make the musicians feel as though that the decisions that they've made are the right decisions and that it was a good decision to go that way.
Yeah.
Make them feel comfortable in their space. And I think that's part of the thing that maybe some drummers these days maybe take for granted or don't pay that much attention to. The thing is, you know, maybe when you go to a Clutch show, maybe some people out there play bass, maybe some of them are drummers, maybe some of them play guitar, but I would guarantee 95% of those people out there sing. Now, they might not sing professionally, but right. They're going to sing in their car, they're going to sing in the shower, or they're going to sing when they're working out or whatever they're doing, right? So everybody wants to be a part of that vocal. Mm. And so I think we as drummers can do a lot to make that vocal feel good.
Yeah.
Whether you play along with it or whether you support it, whether you accent it, you know, we can talk all day about the different approaches to it, but being aware of that vocal and supporting it, I think makes the listener enjoy the music that much more.
Totally. I mean, that's refreshing to hear, and it goes with something Brad and I talk about a lot, which is, you know, not all drummers are songwriters. I'm afraid that they're not. Some people aren't. I wish they were. But not all music really lends itself to that either. But personally, I do not finish a drum part until the vocal part's done, because I don't understand how you can really write a song, especially a song you're supposed to deliver with a chorus, with a hook, with all these things that's supposed to become ear candy for someone, and you're going to do something that battles that. So it's refreshing to hear about the way you think about it.
Well, you know, it's a different mindset. You know, there's other ways to approach the drums. For me, I get satisfaction out of that. Mm-hmm. I get some satisfaction out of being able to, you know, play a cool fill and, you know, being able to come out of it. Oh, wow, that sounded good on recording. That's one level of enjoyment. But to be able to hear the song as a whole and listen to that vocal and know that I did everything I could to make that vocal feel as good as it could at that time. Mm-hmm. That's for me, I get more enjoyment out of that.
Yeah. And is one of the tricks do you all live around each other?
We do.
So is one of the tricks to the longevity of Clutch, is it the idea that no idea is a bad idea when you guys get into the room, like an openness between the members?
No doubt about it. And I'm thankful for that, because I have a lot of stupid ideas. but it's really wide open, and we try to create an atmosphere in which we can bring ideas to the table, and you know, we can try just about anything.
That's awesome. Well, since we're nearing the end, I'm sure your publicist would want us to talk about the records that you guys are putting out or working on right now. Are they out yet, the singles?
We have a couple things coming out. We have the Weathermaker Vault series, Volume right. 1, is getting ready to come out. And so the Vault series is a collection of songs that we've recorded over the past maybe two and a half years that were not necessarily part of a record. Mm-hmm. Some of them were covers. You know, we did a Cactus song called Evil. We did a ZZ Top song called Precious and Grace.
Nice.
We re-recorded a couple old Clutch songs that we thought were either we that that I thought I played shitty. The first one, Smoke Banshee being the example of that. Or you know, some of them we just re-recorded because we've been playing for years. Electric Worry, for example, we re-recorded only because I think we're better at playing that song now. Uh-huh. And so this is a collection of songs that we recorded just in batches, two or three at a time, and we released them over the course of the last year and a half, roughly.
Right.
And to some degree, it was actually an experiment because we were trying to see what it would be like to release music exclusively in the digital domain.
Right.
And for us, you know, a year and a half ago, that was a completely new concept. You know, we were accustomed to releasing music and you release a CD and you release the vinyl and you release the digital all at once.
Yeah.
We said, let's just try to release one song at a time. Let's do it digitally and let's try different things as far as marketing goes, placement. And for us as label owners, it was a good way to try some new stuff that we hadn't been able to do before that way.
Right. And how did the experiment go?
It was good. I think we learned a lot about it, about marketing, about what it means to release a single. There's a lot of different ways to do it. But each one of those releases was kind of an experiment. Hmm. And then in the end, we put them all on one piece of vinyl. And we're going to release that next month. So that's the Weathermaker Vault series. That's going to be volume one. And we're actually already making plans to get into the studio in December and record some more songs, which will eventually be volume two.
Great.
So we're excited about that.
Are any cool covers, stuff you can tell us what's going to be on that?
I can tell you we're going to try a go-go version of something that's going to be real heavy. That I can't believe you've heard. Okay. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. We were talking about that the other day in band practice. It was actually Neil's idea and it was fucking brilliant. So we're excited about that. We might try doing some acoustic stuff as well. Maybe try a couple of those songs. I like playing in that dynamic because it forces me to play more softly, first of all, which is a challenge as drummers, as you know.
Sure.
And so we'll give that a shot, and I don't know. We'll put them out next year over the course of I don't know maybe the first 6 months of the year, and then in the meantime, hopefully we'll be writing what will be the next album.
Appreciate all that, and thanks. You know, just on a personal note, I really appreciate Clutch. I always have, and you guys are always the example I use. To someone who's like, yo, who the fuck cares? But just do your thing and just keep doing your thing and do it good and you'll be fine. You'll be like Clutch, you know? You'll always have a good career.
Well, I appreciate that, and that means a lot, and we appreciate you, and thank you for saying that.
Awesome. Well, thanks for your time, Jean-Paul. Appreciate it, man.
All right.
Thanks, JP.
Take care.
Okay.
Zoom. Fucking Zoom.
That was a Zoom. Nobody's going to notice, but I notice. It's the first one we did on Zoom.
I really resent, you know, do that other podcast, Tune Up, and he made me start using Zoom. I was like really proudly a couple months into the pandemic.
Without
and I was
Zoom.
Like, and I'm like, I don't have Zoom. I never even used it. I was like, I felt cool. You know, like not having a Facebook account. I was like, yeah, I haven't Zoomed. I don't plan on it. And then he made me do it. Send me one invite to this email. I have like a side email that's like my business side piece email. Right. And he sent one link to it, compromised. All of a sudden, I got spam for days from fucking one Zoom link.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I resent Zoom. I only like it if I bought stock in February. You know?
Yeah, it's probably too late for that, dude.
Oh, yeah, now they're selling Zoom futures. I don't even know what kind of information. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if Zoom had some sort of camera recognition technology that's, like, filming my fucking house and me, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm getting an email that's like, oh, shaving products because his mustache is too long.
You know, like, that's what'll happen when Google buys them. That's exactly what they'll use it for, to identify what you need.
Right. And this is why I need a gas-powered chainsaw. So, anyway, you got socials for Clutch?
Yeah, it's Clutch Official, both Twitter and Instagram.
Okay.
Check it out.
And you know they had to put the official, right? Because some car care company had clutch.com.
There's a lot of clutches.
Yeah. some used fucking auto parts company in like Mississippi was lucky enough to get like clutch.com. You know it.
It's either, Clutch Official. It could be Clutch the band, but that's so lame. Clutch Official is good.
And Brad, we have a Patreon, don't we?
We do have a Patreon.
Tell me about it.
Patreon.com/goingofftrack. You can get some bonus material there. I've been slowly sort of just throwing out snippets. We've had things that, like, I guess some stuff that you would say picked up off the editing room floor kind of conversations. All very good, though. Not throwaway stuff. Just stuff that was, like, after we'd finished the podcast.
You always cut the personal stuff. Once me and my friends on here start getting down on some bullshit, you're like, all right, extra content.
Did you see the video I put up? Because I know you're going to hate it.
Keeneland?
I put up a video of Fat Mike.
Oh, you did? Why am I going to hate
first,
it?
I don't know. We give Fat Mike too much attention. No, it was the first one, his first appearance.
Oh,
it's all the security cam footage from Rubber Tracks.
Whatever. Fat Mike can draw me some traffic. Draw me some traffic, Fat Mike.
Whatever. We got some... I mean, thank you so much for the patrons that we have.
Yeah.
It's a club. You want to join the club?
It's exclusive. Yeah. We need to sell exclusivity. Didn't you see The Social Network?
Benny will respond to any and all questions and requests on...
That's actually true. Yes. People think I'm a lot busier than I am with stuff like that. Like, I get emails from people that are like, I know you're swamped. I'm like, no.
Yeah, if you want to feel like you can text Benny, you can join Patreon and he'll
Oh, do I have to put my phone number up now?
No.
All right. That's fine. I'll get a burner. I've seen The Wire.
We got some great fans there and we really appreciate it. Thanks. If you want to
thank you all.
If there's something that you just like and you want to like throw us a tip, you can do it at Venmo at Off Track and whatever you want, $1.66, I think we've gotten before. Whatever you feel like you want to toss at us, we'll take it all because, we have some expenses with this and we appreciate the help.
You're looking a little skinny.
Am I?
Yeah, you look famished. Are you eating?
I'm riding 15 miles a day on my bike. Maybe I'm losing weight.
What is this job you have? Are you working too much?
I'm doing the fucking Christmas gig again.
I know.
But it's all the way out in Queens and I ride the bike. So it's like 15 miles round trip.
You've been riding your bike to Queens every day?
Yeah.
Wow.
Sunnyside.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
I'm actually really impressed that you do that.
Okay.
To anyone who's listening, who's not from New York, you got to understand... Brad lives like on the FDR.
Yep.
Which is one of two of the busiest highways in New York City. And there is no easy and or safe way to get to Queens. What's your route?
The Williamsburg Bridge. Uh-huh. And then I basically cut straight through the middle of Williamsburg. Like literally through McCarran Park.
Okay.
And then I get on Greenpoint Avenue and go across the bridge into... Whatever that bridge is, it's just a little... And from there, it's pretty industrial.
Yeah, the little one, yeah.
And that goes, like, almost there. I'm within a few blocks of Sunnyside. It goes through Sunnyside. Have you ever been to Sunnyside? It's so adorable.
I haven't in a long,
time. It's like a little
time.
Village out in Queens. It's really nice. Beautiful houses.
I got respect in Queens, okay? That's where half of my family's from.
It's probably... Sunnyside is probably, like, the most sort of, like... culturally rich neighborhood I've ever been in. There's no majority that I can really spot there. It's like
I love it.
There's like Indian, Puerto Rican, Black, White, like very integrated neighborhood. It's really I find it very adorable.
Only downside to Queens is the New York Mets. And maybe LaGuardia. Let's take those two off and then everything else is great. All right. No one here cares about Queens.
Not at all.
But respect to you for making that bike ride
because
it's treacherous and I would never do it. That sounds horrifying. I would make it one day and then be in an Uber. But all right. We'll see you next week. We have a great guest next week. And Brad, eat a little food, will you?
Yes, sir. I'll go do some. I'm going to go get some right now.
All right.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyler Tsinis.
Kayla Itzinis. I'm Kayla Itzinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.